Welcome to the New Books Network.
American life these days is characterized by polarization, separation, worldviews so mutually oppositional they've been compared to pre-Civil War days. Today's guest shares his insights into the fundamental ideas that characterize and have historically characterized the American schism. Hello, everyone. And welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. I'm pleased to welcome Seth David Radwell to the show today to talk about his important book, American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. Seth David Radwell holds a master's degree in public policy from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. An internationally known business executive, Radwell has served as president of eScholastic, the digital arm of the global children's publishing and education company, and as president of Bookspan Bertelsmann, where he developed book clubs for diverse readership. Seth David Radwell, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Renee. It's such a pleasure to be here with you this morning.
Before we get to your book, tell us a little about yourself. Who or what were some of the significant influences on your own intellectual development?
Well, most of my professional career has been in business as running and building consumer brands, first in publishing and then in consumer products. I was most recently CEO of a large acne brand in the U.S., the biggest one in the States. And during those different experiences, I had wonderful chances to build teams and companies, and I was a specialist in marketing. But at the same time, I've always had, since my Harvard days, I've always had this deep interest in political discourse and the public policy arena. And as a consequence of that interest, I've been an avid reader of nonfiction, especially history, philosophy, intellectual ideas, those types of topics. And it was only with that background of fascination in these areas, it was only a couple of years ago when I noticed how poorly the public discourse had become. In fact, in my view, the entire political debate had collapsed. And I decided to then stop what I was doing professionally to focus on this project, American Schism.
Well, to stop your ongoing professional activities or to curtail them very much is real commitment. Are you worried about America's future?
Absolutely, Renee. I mean, what really motivated me was I couldn't imagine, as I watched as political discourse collapsed, and increasingly as the pursuit of objective truth, which is kind of the foundation of modern society, which I'll come back to in a second. But I watched that start to disappear. And what I noticed was that my peers, C-level executives in business, who I've been in touch with, I have a great network in the business community. I've been fortunate to have built a wonderful group of peers. But I watched over the last few years as the idea of political discussion had become a third rail. In other words, they preferred to keep their heads in the sand as opposed to discussing something that might be controversial or bring on the wrath of some group. And I thought to myself, the cocktail party moment, if you will, was when I thought to myself, if we can't discuss these issues with a rational perspective, And if we let rancor and acrimony crowd out all of this debate, our democracy is at risk. I mean, how are we going to hand a democracy to our children? And so at that point, which is about 2.5-3 years ago, I started on what I call an investigative tracing. I wanted to find out where the roots of our divisions came from. I was convinced that they had strong antecedents in our history, and that investigation took me back to the Enlightenment.
All right. Well, that's the perfect beginning. Let's start with the fundamental idea thesis of your book, which is that there are two conflicting ideas, radical Enlightenment and moderate Enlightenment, and that they have been struggling for prominence throughout American history. So tell us, what is the difference between the two?
Sure.
And we'll start with that.
We'll start with that. Okay, great. Well, this is really important because you nailed it. This division, this schism that started during the Enlightenment has played a role throughout our history, and it's quite important to understand. So what is it? Well, as many of your listeners probably know, during the Enlightenment, the political construct was the social contract. That's what the great thinkers, whether it was Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau in Europe, or our founders, what they were focused on. And it turns out there were two radically different visions for what America could be amongst our founders. On one hand, you had Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Paine, who are called what I call the radical enlighteners. And by the way, this framework of radical versus moderate enlightenment actually isn't mine. It's borrowed from a professor who's a great expert from Oxford and Princeton, the Enlightenment, a guy named Jonathan Israel, who I've been in touch with and actually wrote the foreword for the book. But in any case, let me explain the difference between these two visions. So you've got these the radical enlightenment, and then you have people like John Adams, Alexander Hamilton, ultimately George Washington, who are part of what is called the moderate enlightenment. So, and the difference is the following. I'm going to simplify it because it's actually quite nuanced, as you know when you read the book. But there are two fundamental differences between these two groups. The radicals believe that the only legitimate form of government in a social contract was a bottom-up government, representative democracy of the people, that the people had to form the government and have a strong voice in the government. On the contrary, the moderates believe the role of governing was to be done by people who were enlightened like themselves at the time, the aristocrats, the people who were educated, and what today we would call the elites. And you know, famously, Alexander Hamilton would be a great example of this. He was a genius and had become he was self-made originally, but became quite a quote-unquote aristocrat and was in that circle in New York. And he believed that government required the best and the brightest, and it was the responsibility of the educated to govern on behalf of the masses. And so that the notion of what form of the government actually takes, whether it's a democratic republic or whether it's what I'd call an aristocratic republic, was the first major element of the schism. And I'll come back to it in a second, but that just to ground it for your listeners. The second one had to do with the nature of religion. So the radicals, especially the French radicals, had documented to a great degree the aspect of history where the monarchy, the kings, would collude with the clergy in order to together keep control and oppress the people. In fact, one of the famous French moderate enlighteners, Voltaire, had a wonderful quote that reflects this thinking. He wrote that si Dieu n'existait pas, il faudrait l'inventer, which means if God didn't exist, we'd have to invent him, indicating that religion was an important element to keep people moral and in line and participating productively in society. And the moderates had that view, whereas it was the radicals who really believed in a complete separation of civic affairs from religious faith-based affairs, what today we call the separation of church and state. In fact, Jefferson wrote that not only in this new country we were forming should we have freedom of religion, but we should have freedom from religion. So those two differences, amongst many others, formed the basis what to become the first set of political parties and the first real contest, the real contending vision of what our country should be. And what's fascinating about this period of our history, Renee, and as you know, I go into this in some detail in the book, is the 12 years between the Declaration of Independence, which was an expression of the radical Enlightenment school, and the Constitution 12 years later, there was a tremendous swing, a shift from this radical mindset to the much more moderate mindset. Now, that shift is described in great detail in the book, and I think readers need to understand it because it became a model, a pattern that would happen throughout our history. This shift between different aspects, different poles of what our democracy, what our republic is all about. And so I'd love to tell you a little bit more about what was important in that shift, but suffice it to say for now that the fundamental constitution that emerged 12 years later is a much more radical document relative to the Declaration. The Declaration says all are created equal, which was at its time the most radical document ever written. I mean, think about it. All men are created equal, endowed by their creators with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet by the Constitution, much of the Constitution, while it did have a House of Representatives that was proportionally democratic, most of the structure in the Constitution had strong guardrails to protect against democracy because people like Hamilton and Adams and other moderates feared democracy. They eschewed democracy. They felt that democracy was an expression of the mob. And the guardrails were such like the Senate and the strong executive and the president. And in fact, the fundamental fact that at the time, only white men with property could vote. So the Constitution was much more of a radical, I'm sorry, of a moderate enlightenment expression than was the original promise of America, the Declaration. And our history of America reflects that swing back and forth.
Yes, and that's certainly an issue today, structurally, and we'll get back to that.
Yes.
But first, talk a little bit about how these two forms of enlightenment are integrated into today's tribal, identity-based arguments and animus.
Right. Well, so this back and forth between these two poles during our founding, which again was very much influenced by the great thinkers in Europe, ended up creating, for example, the first real bitterness. I mean, today we think we're divided. We have, let's call it, tremendous tribal conflict, so to speak, as you correctly note. The enmity, the rancor that developed between what became the Federalists of Hamilton and the Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans was so intense that there were very strong similarities to the dialogue today. We didn't have Twitter, but there were pamphlets that were written constantly that were extremely critical of the opposing points of view. And there was a lot of what we today would call yellow journalism, things reported that were based on half-truths or exaggerated ideas. So in some ways, it was very similar to what we see today. And what the book American Schism shows, Renee, is that over the course of our history, we've always had strong disagreements about policy issues, and that it's usually that's healthy, that's normal, and it's important for an open society. But it's when that debate became filled with unreason, with rancor, with acrimony, with hate, or with overly emotional content, that's when we had trouble, like the Civil War. So in other words, there's always a balance in this debate, a balance of elements that are based on reason and empirical observation, what we call facts or truths, as well as emotions. There's always a balance, but it gets out of whack sometimes. And it certainly got out of whack in some periods of time during the founding period. And I would argue, as I do in the book, that it's out of whack today. We have today that we've abandoned rational ideas in our debate, and we focus on these emotional triggers, which is entirely counterproductive. I'll come back to that. But to answer your question, this pattern is very important to understand. And I believe that, why is the book so focused on the Enlightenment? Well, the Enlightenment, it's important for your listeners who may be not as familiar with history to understand, is really the framework for the entire modern society. I mean, as a way of thinking about it, sometimes I when I give talks to students, I say that if you measure prosperity in society from any objective measure, let's take life expectancy. 200 years ago, life expectancy across the globe was 30 years. Today, as we know, it's over 70 years. 200 years ago, 4/5 of the world, the population, lived in extreme poverty. Today, about 1/5 of the world lives in that same level of poverty. So my point being is the modern framework that was birthed during the Enlightenment ended up creating tremendous prosperity because of its focus on two things, empirical observation and reason. And yet, one of the motivations for me writing this book was that I feel that those are at risk today, where many are willing to throw that away in the name of some faith or some cult or some in-group that they feel very good to be part of and enjoy attacking an out-group. That tribal nature is threatening what is, in fact, the modern structure of the scientific method and reasoned debate that have served us so well.
Well, it goes very deep, doesn't it? Because you use the word modern to talk about the Enlightenment and the time after that.
Right.
But we are postmodernists today, and
yes,
truth is much less agreed upon and in fact, even valued. Everyone is entitled to have his or her or their own truth. And instead of facts and history, we have narrative. So
correct. Yes.
So
yes, you've nailed the core issue, which is in this postmodern world, and in the book I sometimes call it this lay postmodernism that we live in today, everyone's allowed to have their own truth. But you know what? There's aspects of the postmodern movement that have been tremendously valuable. They've brought, the whole intent of the philosophical postmodern movement, which has affected, as we, every form of society, architecture, art, history, narrative, as you point out. The intent was to point out how biased the traditional narratives are and how important it is to bring other voices and other ideas into the conversation. And from that perspective, I think postmodern thinking is very valuable. But here's what we sort of threw out the baby with the bathwater. I hate to use that analogy, but there's a wonderful book out now called The Constitution of Knowledge by a guy named John Rauch. And he explains in the book how we've built this constitution of knowledge by using a structure that focuses on transparency, testing of ideas, openness, peer review, expertise, and that nothing is everything is provisionally true. In other words, an idea is true until it's proven not true, but that we can't throw out the entire constitution of knowledge because we have different narratives. And so that's where it gets very tricky. If I say to you, this is a glass of water, and I hold it up to you and I say, and you say, no, it's not. The whole premise of our modern society is the following. I should be able to demonstrate to you that there are, in fact, two hydrogen molecules for every oxygen model, and they're bound, and this is why it's water. And then at the end of the demonstration, you being a rational person who's not emotionally tied to this should be able to say, you're right, it's a glass of water. So that we need that kind of reasoned, fact-based, empirical approach to building truth, to be able to conquer problems like pandemics and to develop vaccines and to solve things like climate change. We need this framework of the constitution of knowledge. And so my thrust of the argument in the book is that, yes, postmodern thinking is valuable, but it doesn't mean we can completely throw out objective truth. Everyone doesn't get their own facts. As I used to say in business often, Renee, when teams would present ideas for marketing, they would present these great, wonderful ideas and plans. And I would always say, in God we trust, but everyone else has to bring the data. And in other words, I want to see the data. The data matter. And I feel like in debate today too much, the data seem not to matter.
Now that's postmodernism, but there have been more traditional forms of counter-enlightenment, of challenges yes. to enlightenment reasoning. Tell us about those.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because on one hand, American schism is very much this tracing of the as we talked about before, these two enlightenment visions, this radical versus moderate. But there's another struggle. There's another big pendulum, if you will, in the book. And that's between the whole notion of enlightenment thinking and counter-enlightenment, as you point out. So starting, you know, the founding of our country was probably the most secular period of our history. Soon after, there was a period called the Second Great Awakening, which was a very important movement in many ways. I mean, it really was a religious revival, but in many, so it brought faith back into the conversation and on the front burner, if you will. But it also had some very important aspects to it, the Second Great Awakening. For example, it gave women a voice, a significant voice in the ideas of the day. In the founding generation, most of the actors in the U.S. were men. And women, because the men of the households were working, it was the women who often went to the original revival meetings and brought their families. So women became active leaders in society, number one. Number two, many of those same women also led a strong abolitionist push. As we know, we probably should have mentioned the great contradiction of our founding, of course. As I talked about before, we had this Declaration of Independence, which said all are created equal, and yet half the states had chattel slavery. So the slavery and African Americans are and how they were treated over the course of our history is the great contradiction of our founding. And it was during the Second Great Awakening when abolitionists really gained steam, as did other movements like temperance, because many of the men drank too much, and so that movement also gained steam during that time. But the side effect, the arrival of the Second Great Awakening, also challenged this Enlightenment framework, because it said, you know, reason is not the most important thing. We need to have faith, and it brought counter-Enlightenment, you know, faith-based arguments back to the fray. And that also has been a pattern in America over our history. This idea of using, you know, science and reason and observation versus how much faith affects our public realm. And in the book, as you've seen, I struggle with that and point out how important, of course, faith is in all of our lives, many of our lives, but that when faith interferes in the civic realm in a way that has undue influence for one group or is persecutory towards another, that's a problem, and that's counter-enlightenment. That's not what the Enlighteners intended. And so counter-enlightenment, to your point, is a big factor. And in fact, I would say it's the counter-enlightenment strength that's very relevant today in this tribalism we described before. In other words, people won't believe that this is a glass of water. As Trump famously said, he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and people would still support him. And there's a lot of evidence that people will do things that are non-rational, that defy reason, like all the conspiracy theories, of course, we see. Though that's classic, if I can use the term, counter-enlightenment. And so that's a big part of the story as well.
Now, the counter-enlightenment was not exclusive to America. Or the various forms of counter-enlightenment. But how does the concept of American exceptionalism fit into your perspective?
Oh, I love that question. So before I answer that, I will say that the counter-enlightenment in France is what led to the collapse of the revolution into the Reign of Terror, which is discussed in great detail in the book, because it's important. In the U.S., our counter-enlightenment movement wasn't as destructive, but it had some destructive elements, which are discussed. But your question about, you know, American exceptionalism is really great, because after doing the tracing of the book, in the third part of the book, I pose three core questions about why America is so unique. And at the end of the day, it boils down to what makes American exceptionalism. And I would argue and as they do in an American Schism, is that it's not about our military strength or our prowess, or it's about two aspects of what we've been able to do over our history, which have made us the beacon of hope in the world. One is that we're the best example of self-government in the history of the planet. And even with all our flaws, with all our problems in our government, we still are the best example of self-government that's ever existed. And we've managed, as Benjamin Franklin famously challenged us, we've managed to keep the republic despite almost losing it numerous times during our history. And the second reason that makes America exceptional, in my view, is we've had a model of meritocracy, which means that you didn't have to be noble. You didn't have to be of noble birth to be successful. That based on hard work and ingenuity and our own personal development, we could create a wonderful life. That model of anyone can make it here, so to speak, which I think is grounded in our model of meritocracy, that is also what makes America exceptional, what makes us the envy of the world. And precisely, as I said before, I feel like if we lose those two things, we'll lose American exceptionalism. And I fear that the last couple of years, it seems that we are.
Well, when you mention the Declaration of Independence asserting that humans are all equal, all men are created equal, we won't get into the female side of the equation. What they meant, we believe, is equality before the law.
That's correct.
Equality. Correct.
And by the way, in the book, I point out that, in fact, Jefferson's notion, as is becomes evident from his notes and all that went into writing the Declaration, and of course, this is debated by Jeffersonian scholars to this day, but I assert that he meant all people, not only men and women, but African Americans. I believe he fundamentally believed they were created equal, despite the contradiction of him being a slave owner personally. And that's discussed in some length, and many Jeffersonian scholars have discussed that for their whole careers. But yes, that was where we started out in the Declaration.
But so equality before the law, I think that's something that very few people would disagree with in democratic countries. But that concept has morphed into equity, egalitarianism, and you write about equality of voice.
Right.
So what's the difference? What are all these equal terms?
So I'm glad you brought that up. That's a big part of the third part of the book, is explaining this. So I think from my perspective, the great contribution of the French enlighteners, people like Diderot and Holbeck and many of them, Condorcet, who wrote the original French Constitution in 1792, as well as the Declaration of Rights of Man, their contribution was really defining this equality more specifically. So, of course, the Declaration of Independence did one very important thing that was maybe the most important. Jefferson replaced the word property that meant in Locke's, John Locke, the British philosopher's original foundation, and in much of the Scottish Enlightenment. The idea was that the inalienable rights that men had in a social contract were life, liberty, and property. And property at the time was quite interesting because it was, who had property? Well, the wealthy had property. The aristocrats had property. Most people, the masses, didn't have property. So it may seem trivial, but by Jefferson replacing property with the pursuit of happiness, which is a much more egalitarian idea, everyone can pursue happiness. Everyone has the right to pursue happiness. Think about that. That's a much more radical Enlightenment notion. Now, to your point, how do we think about equality before the law as one thing, but also the right of to pursue happiness? And this becomes very much a foundation of why everyone has the right to opportunity, what we call today equality of opportunity, that that in I'm not sure if you're familiar with or your listeners are with John Rawls, who's a great philosopher from the 70s. But the theory of justice, he lays out what the criteria are for equality of opportunity, and meaning that everyone has to have the same starting line. And what I argue in the book is that our meritocracy needs to have as close as we can get to the ideal, it's never perfect, of equality of opportunity, which today we don't have, we're moving away from. So what the French Enlighteners said was, for in order for a democratic republic to work, first of all, you need, and for people to keep their inalienable rights and to be, have a voice in government, you need an educated populace. So guess what? One of the responsibilities of the state is to ensure that citizens have a civic education and can participate, can know how to advocate for their interests. So that's ironic, because I argue in the book that, of course, civic education, which was important when you and I were growing up, has become crowded out by the focus on science, technology, and math. Not that those aren't important, they are, but civic education is quite important as well. And so the French Enlighteners laid out in the, in the 1792 Constitution all of the elements of education that needed to be provided, a secular education to citizens, number one. Number two, they believed, as there's a great French radical, Baron d'Holbach, he was an aristocrat originally, but he believed that, to your point, while everyone was, all humans were born with the capacity of reason and empirical observation, in other words, equal, that they didn't stay equal their whole lives. People developed their skills, and some were pretty, and some were smart, and some became wealthy. And but the whole purpose of the social contract was to ensure that if you didn't have enough, if you couldn't succeed in society as a self, as an independent being, the state helped you. That there was a safe, what we call today a safety net, and that in fact the goal was to try to get everyone able to pursue as best as they could their innate abilities, to develop those. That was the role of the state. My point being is that I think there's a very clear discussion of what equality means in its different aspects in the book. And I think that's very important for us to understand. It's about equality before the law. But I think the French Enlighteners argued, as did others, that it was also about equality of opportunity. And that's part of what I describe when I talk about a meritocracy.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, meritocracy is being challenged now as well. Egalitarian societies. Now, is that, in your view, the same as a form of equality?
Yes. So this is a great question. Absolutely, meritocracies are being challenged. There have been books that have been written about how our meritocratic model has failed. So I differentiate between two things, which I think it's a useful framework. There's a notion of equality of opportunity, as I mentioned, and equality of outcomes. In other words, ever since the development of Marxist thinking in the 19th century, and it's thousands of permutations, there's a notion that maybe one of the roles of government in a contract is to make sure everybody has the same outcome, the same. And I very much argue excuse me, in the book, that that's not the American ideal. That, you know, in a capitalist country, we value how achievements are measured and rewarded. And in fact, that is one of the fundamental, I mentioned there that there were three core questions. That's one of them. How in a society do we measure achievement and recognize and reward achievement? And in a system of equality of outcomes, it's very different than inequality of opportunity, which I would argue at our best we've done at times. Like, for example, after World War II, with things like the GI Bill, when we enabled all of these GIs to come back and start productive lives in the country. And other times, in I think LBJ's years, we made a huge leap forward on the recognition that we weren't doing very well at achieving equality of opportunity. So I think at times we've done it. And that's very different than saying everybody has to have the same outcome, which is very much advocated by certain countries and by certain philosophers and political actors. So I think that's what's important to differentiate. And I guess if you wanted to define me in political terms, that would probably make me a centrist, because I very much believe in the importance of the establishment in recognizing and institutions in recognizing achievement and distributing rewards that people work hard for and earn. But I reject the notion of equality of outcomes. I explain in the book that one of the reasons why I reject it is because it's in practice, it's been shown to never achieve its desired goals, because invariably corruption and the new capitalists become the bureaucrats who make the rules. And so there's, as Winston Churchill famously said, and you know, I couldn't have said it better. Democracy is the worst form of government, except that every other one is, you know, it's better than any other form that we've found. So it's a little bit of that, if you will, Renee, that I'm getting at. But in the book, I describe this in more detail.
When you and I talk about these issues, our assumption, unexpressed, is that equality and opportunity and egalitarianism all has to do with individuals.
Yes.
We can celebrate individual differences.
Yes.
But there's another way that other democracies look at it, and some in the United States look at it as well, which is by groups.
Yeah.
So that if group X has Y level of income, let's say, or educational achievement, that compared with group Y that's doing better or worse means, or is interpreted to mean, it's more or less fair, more or less equal. What do you think about that?
I think we have to be very careful in confounding when we talk about group differences and things. This has been an area that's led to not only very, vociferous debate, but very misguided policies and much persecution and xenophobia. So I think, of course, all humans are different across all measures, and groups have differences and individuals have differences. The point is to try to achieve equalities of opportunity for everyone, irrespective of what group they belong to. And therefore, I don't think what group people, whether they're you know, of a certain religious faith or racial background or ethnic background, that shouldn't be the first element of how they're viewed or judged in society. And of course, you know, that sounds very, very obvious, but you know, the notion of, let's say, color blindness or faith. But we, and our history of the country has been one of where we say these principles, like in the Declaration, or we have, let's say, in Reconstruction, which I talk a lot about in the book, we have these new amendments that for the first time give equal rights, quote unquote, de jure, according to the law, to African Americans. And by 1868, 80% of former slaves were voting. But that's far from the end of the story, because we know that de jure and de facto are different things. So after Reconstruction fails, 10 years later, by 1878, and the Ku Klux Klan is going rampant, and there are new codes with the precursor of Jim Crow laws are instituted. All of a sudden, from 80% in 1868, in 1878, 5% of African Americans are voting in the South. What a pendulum swing that is. So my point being is that getting to equality of opportunity is a lifelong struggle. It's it's like the same way as we want to perfect our democracy. So it's a glass half full, half empty, I'm saying, Renee. Egalitarianism is a principle that we can work towards, and we're never quite there. But I see the glass as half full. In other words, I wouldn't throw out the system because it's not perfect. And that's what I discuss in the book, what I think is frustrating about coming back to our debate today, and maybe this is a good transition point, is that both the extremes, the extreme right and the extreme left, are their approaches are counterproductive. The extreme right, in my view, is completely willing to ignore truth. In other words, live in their own reality. Like, the big lie that Trump won the election, which, of course, we know is a fabrication and one that's gotten enormous promotion. On the left, there's this notion, which is sometimes called cancel culture, of shaming people for not having or being self-righteous about not having correct political views and thus forcing people to be silent. I mean, it's happening in universities. It's written. My argument in the book is that 70% of Americans, according to my research, are part of what I call the frustrated majority, meaning that they believe that neither of these extremes represent their views. But yet their views are being crowded out because of the nature of media emphasizing these extremes. You know, there's been some study on this, and this 70% or more frustrated majority believe that we need to compromise on public policy issues, that we need to listen to each other. And it really reflects the approach that many are now taking to reject the political discourse, the collapse of it, and to try to rehabilitate it in recent years. I'm part of a group, Renee, called Braver Angels, which is getting people of different political persuasions, left and right, to talk to each other and to listen and to explore issues. And I'm doing a lot of work with this group because it's very much consistent with how I view the problems in the book American Schism. So I think that to your question, I think the dialogue today is this tribal, fight, the struggle, where symbols mean a lot as opposed to substance, where people are triggered to support their in-group and attack the out-group because it gives them incredible endorphin rushes. I mean, we all have these natural human impulses, which are part of our evolutionary history, of feeling good when we attack an out-group and when we're part of an in-group. We all know this because if you've ever been at a sports stadium, you know how good it feels to root for your team. So I think that's human. But what I point out in the book is that that's not a good mindset in which to make public policy. That's left for the sports arena. So we have to change how we talk to each other. And in fact, the third part of the book has two major changes it talks about. One is a set of structural changes, which I think are pretty straightforward. And the other is a mindset change in how we have a dialogue. And that's the mindset change is the area that I'm working on with people like this Braver Angels group. And it's also, if you will, Renee, it's my call to action for people who are in the frustrated majority, who reject the extreme left and right. I'm asking them to reclaim their voice, that even though social media may give more attention to the people who are screaming and to the people who are outrageous, we have to throw the lunatics out of their leadership in the asylum and take it over and run it ourselves. And that's what I mean by fighting unreason with reason.
So apropos the lunatics running the asylum,
right?
Why are Americans so angry? And not only in political discourse, although Trump won in 2016 on a wave of voter anger, and actually it isn't just Americans who are so angry, but Americans are more angry, it seems, than other countries, because besides the political context, there are attacks on flight attendants, yes. there are random shootings. Yes. There seems to be a level of, and maybe it comes from your frustrated majority, I don't know, what just, let's just look at the emotion. What's it about? Why is everyone so angry?
There's no question that there's been a brewing rage amongst many Americans for many, many years. And I try to do some analysis of this. I think it goes back to really way before Trump. I think that, you know, ever since the last 50 years, let's say, the establishment in America has followed a framework of global capitalism. It's sometimes called by thinkers neoliberalism. This mm-hmm. this model of free markets and it's and competition and no government regulation or as little as possible, as Reagan famously said, you know, government is the problem. That framework, that neoliberalist framework, I believe, has left many Americans behind, and it has. The establishment has ignored the fact that it has not worked for many parts of our country, especially rural areas and especially areas that are away from the coastal elites, quote unquote. And the reason why it hasn't worked is because the model, I mean, so for example, there are in many small towns today, and I discuss this in the book, adults whose parents, by the way, were laid off in the first wave of manufacturing outsourcing back in the 80s, and already started, those small rural areas often started suffering. Today, those communities have been devastated, and many of the churches have moved away. They're all of their civic activities, like their 4th of July parade, and what created the community elements have eroded. And a lot of this is economic, because I think the establishment has shown disdain towards this part of America for quite a long time. And when I say establishment, I mean both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, you know, as much as Hillary Clinton discussed the deplorables, you know, Mitt Romney talked about the takers. And I think, you know, the reason why Trump was such a savior to so many Americans is because he was the first, he got it. He was a politician who wasn't really a politician, but who understood that he was one of them. He recognized the wrath, the anger, the brewing feeling of being neglected by white working class Americans. And he tapped into that in a huge way. And that's the emotional bond that he formed with so many Americans, which has been so powerful. Now, to your point, Renee, this is not an American-only phenomenon. All over the world, especially in liberal democracies, we're struggling with these forces. You can see what's going on in France today. Much of the world is moving towards a different form of government. Autocracy is the model that seems to be working well. When I say well, I put that in air quotes. Whether it's Xi's China or Putin's Russia or Erdogan in Turkey, this notion of autocracy is easier. And one of the things that needs to be discussed, and I do so in American Schism, is why do we want a democracy in the first place? And why is that important? And I argue that democracy is, I hate to use this term, but it's an epistemologically superior form of government. And what that means is, epistemology is how we gain knowledge. And in an autocracy, edicts are handed down by the autocrat and people follow them or face the consequences. The whole concept of democracy is that we talk to each other and listen and learn and understand different perspectives and together come to a compromise solution. That's the model that Daniel Allen from Harvard talks in such eloquence about in much of her work, which is cited in my book. What does it mean to have a democracy, and how do we do that, and why is it a better form of government, and why should we strive to have that? In one way, I believe this is the challenge of our time, Renee. If the 20th century, to some degree, can be characterized by a struggle between our open form of society in America with other forms of repressive society, such as fascism, Nazism, communism, that was very much the struggle of the 20th century. I think the struggle so far of the 21st century seems to be between that same form of open society and a model of autocracy that's not an illiberal society, as the model in Hungary is, where people cannot say whatever they want. There is not freedom of the press. There's a government-led narrative by the autocrat that keeps people in line. And that is becoming the model. I mean, it's very tricky. In Xi's China, one could argue that from a utilitarian perspective, if we looked at, you know, one of the great utilitarian philosophers, or John Stuart Mill, or more Chinese today are better off than they were 30 years ago by far. There's a huge Chinese middle class. So there's been a tremendous prosperity for many people in China, but it's still a repressive regime, I would argue.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And all those countries you mentioned, the other ones, Russia, Turkey, Hungary, they're not really doing that great from a utilitarian point of view either.
Or Brazil, but, another example.
Yeah. Is there a country that you look toward that is getting democracy better, not perfectly, but...
Yeah, nobody's getting it perfectly, but I think Western Europe is doing better in some ways, even with all their problems. I mean, I think there are things we have to fix. Like, for example, it's clear to me that, and I think to many Americans in the frustrated majority, that our political establishment, our political industry is broken. It spends much more money and effort at staying in office, at getting reelected, than in solving problems. And there's been a lot written about this. So I think it has to be changed. I mean, you know, our founders intended for the Constitution to be malleable, to change over time with every generation. And I think I argue for things in the book American Schism. I argue for term limits and why they're important. I argue for a concept called ranked choice voting to break the lock of dominance that the two parties have on our system here. I mean, there are many structural things that can be done to improve our democracy. To answer your question, I think in the book I compare America often to France, because the reason why I pick France is because France also, in many ways, of course, the French Revolution and American revolutions were tied; they were part of one overall movement. And France also intended to had a secular state separate from church and state, and also as a multiracial society. Now, they're not completely similar. There are great differences. France, of course, has tremendous issues with its former colonies and a whole complex dynamic about French citizens who are from former colonial France. We can talk about that. It's really a whole topic in and of itself. But I think it's useful to see how countries like France, how the Netherlands, how Germany are dealing with these issues. And that's another aspect of what's useful about comparing what works and what doesn't work in a democratic republic.
Finally, Seth, you're saying that the national discourse needs to get back to being a debate about ideas. But we see the power of emotions like anger, hate, and fear, of the feelings of tribalism and identity politics. How do we move from that to a more reasoned debate?
Renee, I think the answer to that question lies in how we started our conversation. I mentioned at the beginning that one of the motivations that led me on this path was that private sector leaders, my peers in industry, in society, had most recently in the last couple of cycles put their heads in the sand. They didn't want to get involved. And I think it's those people in the frustrated majority, who are the key to taking back the conversation, wrestling it back from the extremes and re-establishing, rehabilitating a conversation based on ideas, based on respect, based on empirical observation and reason. So that's this campaign called Fight Unreason with Reason, and I'm actively promoting it so that people who are in this frustrated majority cannot be silent. So I think it's only going to get better if we meaning the 70% frustrated majority, take back the conversation and reject out of hand the types of tactics that are used in often on Twitter and in social media today, which is insults, personal ad hominem attacks, debate that does not use facts, that distorts ideas, and that doesn't listen. I think those are the things that we have to reject in our conversation. And accordingly, for this past Thanksgiving holiday, I sent to all of my readers and listeners, I sent them a guide for how to have a conversation about important ideas over the Thanksgiving table without getting into arguments and fights. And that's what I think we have to do more and more, as we discussed today.
It's a great idea, and more power to you, and it's really to us. We all have to be involved in it, and you're setting a good example.
Thanks
for your important insights. Sorry.
Renee, this has been such a pleasure for me to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for taking the time to share your views with us.
My pleasure.
And thanks as well to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff. If you've enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to the Van Leer series on ideas wherever you find your podcasts.